Hello and welcome to Platforms and Pitfalls. I'm Rowan.
And I'm Blue.
And we're not here to talk about game design, but game awards. Not our own, of course, but of what games got game awards from other publications. We're going to look at the awards given out by Giant Bomb, Polygon, and IGN over the last 5 years and see if we can identify what makes a game of the year in quote marks. Not unlike movies, there are certain qualities that are more likely to gain traction as an award winner. That is sort of separate to quality. Often in movies, these things are called Oscar bait, and we're going to try and see if we can find these traits and use them to predict game of the year. Of course, all predictions are kind of doomed to fail, but we're hoping we can find some interesting answers and find out maybe why people pick certain games.
I'm sure there's going to be interesting things to talk about with these games. They're game of the year games, for Pete's sake. Like, obviously they're interesting for some reason or another.
Although it's worth saying that, like, we're not necessarily talking about the quality of these games per se, like whether they're good or bad is not quite relevant to our discussion, despite being award winners. It's more about the qualities that they share that make them these sort of typical candidates, I guess, and if we can nail that down. And so we're going to look at our first year, 2014. So, 2014. This was a year where not much in terms of hardware came out. It was perhaps the year where the Wii U gave its last big hurrah with Smash Brothers and Bayonetta 2, and when the Xbox and PS4 were settling into their patterns, but the past consoles hadn't quite gone away yet. In fact, all the games we talk about had last-gen ports. So Polygon and IGN nominated Dragon Age Inquisition by BioWare, and Giant Bomb gave the award to Shadow of Mordor by Monolith Productions. As you might remember of these games, if you know them, they both had a huge emphasis on open world gameplay and some level of like player direction. So my experience of Dragon Age is that it sort of does its player expression through the romances and those conversation trees. Whereas Shadow of Mordor is much more systemsy. It's much more the Nemesis system, which dynamically creates these sort of player narratives for you. That's how it like defines itself.
I had so much hope for the Nemesis system. I fully expected it to be one of those things we started seeing in a lot more places, where we get this sort of dynamic personal experience with a game that tries to make an antagonist kind of like molded by your actions, and we never quite got there.
Yeah, it's really interesting how bad we can be as predictors of like what's going to take off, because there were so many pieces at the time. We're like, Shadow of Mordor is like the game of the future. Everything's going to emulate this, and we found pretty strongly that it hasn't. Like, there's a few games that have more systemic elements than they used to. But there's not quite the level of like personalization that has gone on like in the Nemesis system.
But that's the thing, right? Like, it wasn't active personalization either. It was so react, which is what was interesting about it. Because it meant that it was hard for you to just go in and say, I want this to happen, so I'm going to play this way. And it felt more organic for that. I think what I've learned from a lot of stories, not just this one, but this was definitely one of those examples. What I've learned is I now don't say this is what's going to happen. I say, I hope this is what we learn from it.
But outside of like unsuccessful hopes and desires, both these games really have these really massive open worlds. Dragon Age, of course, like leans much more into, and the developers even said much to this effect, like they were much more inspired by the Skyrim environments and the Skyrim sort of approach to these things. Whereas Shadow of Mordor is much more in following the Ubisoft model with its towers and such.
It literally just towers that you climb and that you claim, and then suddenly you can see the map. Was it a formula in 2014?
I think by that point it had been established, but it wasn't a joke at that point.
Yeah, definitely.
I think it took a few more years for it to be a joke, and then it would take a few more for when Breath of the Wild did it for it to be like, you can do that again, I guess. So I think the takeaway from this year is pretty simple, which is that for the Game of the Year contenders, you kind of need to be an open world, possibly. I need a high amount of player choice and reaction to those choices. It's not just the ability to choose things that matters. It's the fact that the world responds back to you. With Dragon Age, that's with the characters responding back to you and forming romances and changing plot elements throughout the way. In Shadow of Mordor, there aren't like narrative paths to take, really. There are a few choices you make that choose which areas you go to, I think, but it's more about how those warlords and captains change in response to you taking them down and such.
Honestly, there's a story in Shadow of Mordor, and I know almost nothing about it, because all anyone ever talks about is the Nemesis system.
And that's the thing, like, it's not about stories in terms of, like, the written plots. It's stories that, like, players tell to people. And that's a key point in a lot of discussions about games producing narratives like this. And even way back with, like, Far Cry 2, that was a huge point. Everyone has a different experience of this game and can tell their own stories. And roguelikes are similar in this sense, too. I don't think, without getting too much in the weeds, which wouldn't really expand the points, there's much more to say about these titles for this, is there?
Not particularly, no. Good standalone titles that... Honestly, it's really hard for me to believe that it's been 5 years since Dragon Age Inquisition. It doesn't feel like it's been that long, but it has, and... Yeah, they are games that, I don't know if stand the test of time is the right phrase, but that I'll remember for a long time, like, and that certainly means something. Like.
Yeah, I think that they're both interesting in one sense, in that Dragon Age Inquisition, I feel, was, not that we're talking too much about quality, but the fact that it chose to be an open world game, like, much more so than its predecessors, kind of hurt it because it lacked the focus of the other games in the series. But at the time, that didn't seem to hurt the critics' reception of it because... that was a thing in vogue, whereas Shadow of Mordor would not work as a more, like, limited-focus game. Like, open world is key to its DNA,
I guess. You needed an excuse to bumble around the map, and your excuse was there were things to do around it, not necessarily that the story was pointing you to all of these places.
Hmm, and that these old captains were, like, a really good thing to have in that environment, just, like, crop up and, like, create these unique player moments.
Yeah, that definitely.
So let's move on to 2015 then. This year was a little notable in that it was the start of the console half upgrades with the new 3DS line. And also, even though everyone forgot, Steam machines started existing this year, which... have gone as well as you can remember them. So we had three different games nominated this year, or given awards this year, I should say. We had Polygon giving Her Story the award, which was by Sam Barlow. We had IGN giving it to Witcher 3, The Wild Hunt. And we had Giant Bomb giving the award to Mario Maker. These are all three really different experiences, unlike 2014's list of games. So Her Story is... an adventure game? An open-ended adventure game, I guess, where your main input is searching through video recordings and transcripts, right?
I think of it as a thriller game, as in movies have, you know, there's a distinction between thriller and horror. I feel like this is a thriller game to me. Like, it is drama, not personified, but its main driving force is drama.
This slow inching of information. So the main thing that I think is interesting about its progression is it's really open-ended, but you won't know what to search for until you watch certain videos, and they'll give you new keywords that you might choose to search for, and that'll unlock new videos. So it's really open. Players will learn information in different ways and come up with different theories and ideas. But there is, like, a slight guidance to how players will progress through it. Not entirely so, but, like, there is some guidance to it. So this sort of fits our currently established ideas, which are that players creating their own stories and having a lot of open possibility space are the important things.
I think possibility space is a really good descriptor, and it's more, more exemplified in this year's examples. Let's keep going on. So Witcher 3 by CD Projekt Red. What hasn't been said about it already? We've actually talked about it on Platforms and Pitfalls before.
Twice.
Yeah, and it's really good, despite the fact that it's not really the kind of game that either of us like.
I want to like it so badly. Yeah. I really want to like it so much.
Personal opinions aside, I cannot argue that objectively it's really strong. It's a very strong entry for a game that allows players to have this massive space to explore and still deliver on such strong narrative moments.
It managed to deliver a lot of like really tight, concise narratives, which these games often struggle with, which I think is really impressive. And one of the big things that The Witcher 3 does is it's a role-playing game where you have a protagonist that's set. You're always Geralt. But you have a lot of room to express your Geralt in different ways. And this is partially just a function of narrative. He is a witcher, a mercenary-type figure, and the role they take in the world is being somewhat impartial and not being too personally tied, which allows it much more easily to be crafted in whichever direction you wish, so everything is in character for him. But doing that allows like the game to have a stronger voice, I think, while letting players like express themselves, which a lot of character-driven RPGs with named protagonists suffer from a bit.
Geralt has personality, but it doesn't overshadow player choice.
Within the possibility space, you've got a whole range of activities. You've got lots of systems to delve into, player builds you can express with, like, is your Geralt a swordsman or a mage or an alchemist? And you can collect things, you can collect trading cards, you can play Gwent. I don't like Gwent, but you can do it. And lots of people do like Gwent enough that they made a Gwent you can buy cards for, even.
Or the digital online game as
well. That's the one I meant, sorry.
Oh, no, because there's a physical version of Gwent.
Oh, that's terrifying. I mean, that's great for those who like it.
Yeah.
So yeah, Witcher 3, I mean, it really falls into much the same vein as Dragon Age and Shadow of Mordor. Open world, lots of player-driven opportunities. The surprise here is Mario Maker, kind of, because it's super hugely player-driven to the point that without other players, there's almost effectively no content.
Yeah, it's I think of Minecraft when I think of what games Mario Maker are like, where it's what you want it to be. You set your own goals for what you want. It's a bit more directed than that because at the end of the day, the goal is always to get Mario from the start of the level to the flagpole or the axe or, you know, the end.
But as players demonstrated, there are so many different ways in which you can make a game into that.
Mm.
Or even like systems, like players made calculators, players made cryptography levels of all things.
Mm.
Like the possibility space is so huge in that it was just a joy to explore.
It's definitely not the first time a game like Mario Maker has existed. Little Big Planet, and it's, you know, there are three versions of Little Big Planet. All of them also feature super interesting level creators that allow you to do all sorts of things. It's not unlike Mario Maker, but something about Mario Maker was different and special. It was a bit easier to work with. It was a lot more accessible. It had a very powerful IP attached to it.
I think that IP and nostalgia is really powerful because even if you don't play a lot of games, Mario's movement is relative. Like, everyone just knows approximately how Mario feels to play. Even though there is actually a lot of variance in how Mario plays in all the games, everyone has a general idea of what to expect when playing, which Little Big Planet doesn't have that luxury. It's a platformer like any other, but also there's like weird gravity to it, there's different physics, there's also things that get in the way of that just flowing as you expect. Mario also has the benefit of being inherently already built around tiles, which Little Big Planet's effort to feel natural didn't have.
Mm.
And a lot of other level makers, that's the thing they suffer from, trying to be more complicated and not having a familiar verb set.
I think that Mario Maker is a very easy choice in hindsight, and it's just impressive that it was there and already showing the promise that it had so early within the year. Because Mario Maker has aged amazingly. It has grown and aged and become even better of a game as it establishes its own rules and conventions. But we're talking about 2015, you know, we're talking about the year it just came out. We're talking about time when people were still definitely getting to grips with what Mario Maker was able to do. And it already seemed very amazing, so.
And this is before it got some basic quality of life things like checkpoints and I don't even remember what else it got. Did it ever get slopes? That was a big controversy for a while.
That was Mario Maker 2.
Oh, save it for the sequel, I guess. And yeah, Mario Maker 2 is this year's thing, and that's gotten a huge patch fairly recently, expanding its possibility space hugely. So I think Mario Maker and her story might initially seem out of place, not being like big mainstream AAA titles, but they both fit in this idea of like a broad possibility space, player-driven ideas, and the ability for players to discuss the games, like, what did my Geralt do in this situation? What did yours do? Did you forgive this person? To her story, who do you think did what?
in building on that, that is definitely super important to the Mario Maker experience, because keep in mind there were two versions of Mario Maker that were released, and the 3DS version got almost no love because you couldn't share your levels online.
It came out another year as well, to be fair, but yeah, the online sharing is was a big part of that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But I will say that is somewhat biased by us being adults and the way that we play games. So I work in schools and I work in elementary schools at the time the 3DS game came out. And I had lots of students who would talk about their games and like they'd meet up in the park and trade levels. Like for a certain group of people, that was exactly what they wanted, more so than having to fiddle around with online codes and things.
Because it was mobile as well.
Yeah. And it's worth, I guess it's worth stating that bias. Adults give these awards, and what adults would say of these things is very different to what kids would say, and it's not a mark against them, but it's not, it's always worth considering that for these sorts of things.
The more you know.
But Mario Maker also came out, it's worth noting that this is like in the rise of Twitch. Like, Twitch had been existing for a while. I think this is when it was getting more and more common and normal to spend a lot of time watching streams.
I'd have to do a bit more research to be able to, like, put any weight behind a statement like that.
My understanding of the rise of Twitch is that while it was around before the PS4 and Xbox One in strong force, them having that functionality built in directly just brought a lot more people to Twitch and streaming in general. And it's just been on a rise ever since 2012, really.
Yeah.
And I think this was, like, just the perfect year for that.
Oh, you're talking about the year. Yeah, sure. Sure. Yeah. I thought you mentioned the game. I'm like, I'm not sure if I'm willing to.
No, sorry. Yeah. Sorry, no. The game came out at just the right point in terms of Twitch's popularity rise.
Yeah.
Like, as everyone was being into it, it's the perfect thing for Twitch streams.
Yeah.
I think we probably said too much, even, and gotten a bit off topic there.
Perhaps.
We've changed our definition a little bit. So it's less about open worldness and more about broad possibilities and the ability for players to talk about these things and have different experiences within a game.
Mm.
So let's move on to 2016 then. A lot of stuff released this year, hardware-wise. We had the next half-step console with the PS4 Pro, and it's also the year of VR, with the Oculus, the Vive, and of course the PlayStation VR. This year, our awards don't quite match up with what we've talked about so far, which is good for discussion, not so good for predictions. Polygon gave the award to Doom 2016, which was by id Software. IGN gave the award to Overwatch by Blizzard. And Giant Bomb gave the award to Hitman from IO Interactive. So we've got two, like, very, very different shooters.
But shooters, right? Like, they're not the kind of space where you normally think about this large possibility in player choice kind of space.
And Doom in particular is, like, a linear, level-based, fairly structured shooter that doesn't have a lot of progression mechanics. Like, there's not a lot of, oh, I made a submarine character. I made a pyrotechnic character. It's just, you are all Doom guy. We are all Doom guy in our hearts.
But it does, like, if you're trying to tie it back at all, we mentioned how powerful nostalgia is. And I know that was in relation to, like, moving copies from Mario Maker and getting into people's hands to begin with.
And making, like, creation accessible by just intuitive understanding.
But that is definitely one of the key points of Doom 2016. It's one of the things that makes people, well, makes me a bit worried about the next one. I know people have said that it's going to be good, but, so this is obviously being recorded before Doom Eternal drops. Doom 2016 was such a breath of fresh air for going back to shooter mechanics at its core and just stripping away a lot of fluff. No sprint button, no reload button.
And no strong emphasis on multiplayer either, which for...
They tried to push that.
There was a multiplayer component that they did push, and also some level creation tools, I believe, right?
And some creative game modes even. But definitely what stands out with 2016 Doom is how good the game felt to play.
Now, do you have a lot of experience playing this game?
I finished it, yeah.
Okay, that's more than me then, which I haven't booted up once. So would you say that there's a lot of room within Doom's play to, like, have a lot of different play experiences? Or is it really, like, most players are experiencing a fairly similar loop and doing it in a fairly similar way. Like, if we both played it, do you think I'd say, like, oh, I did this thing this way, and how'd you do it? And
bit of column A, bit of column B. I am resisting the urge to go into tangents of, and this is what it was like for me. I think that the loops are going to end up being the same, but over a long enough period of time with a shooter as intensive as this, you're going to get moments where you just sneak by, or you barely don't sneak by, and they're all going to be, you know, they're going to be personal, they're going to be awesome, and they're going to be something that's super fun to share. And because the play experiences are going to be similar enough, although it didn't happen in the exact same way, in the exact same spot for someone else, they can, if they've played the game, they get a very good understanding of what you went through, and they, you have that kind of shared reaction as everyone, you know, appreciates what you've been through. So at the very least, I think it's a really good, it was at the time, a really good way to rekindle old school nostalgia and then drive people to share that story with everyone else. And that was a common language between people who played Doom 2016.
So I think maybe in this case, it's sort of like an overwhelming focus that is really what puts this on these lists.
Yeah. And attention to small details as well. You know, when I think back to it, I think back to specific moments, and half of these moments are Easter eggs. Like, yeah, if you fall into the molten lava at certain points, the Doom Marine's hand as he goes down does the Terminator thumbs up before it sinks below the line. You know, like, that's a neat little Easter egg that they, that was really fun to find things like that.
And then Overwatch, so far, everything we've talked about, even if it has an online component, is primarily played single player. Like Mario Maker, you do a lot online, but you don't play with someone else for the most part. And even 2, you can, but seems a bit messy. So this is entirely multiplayer, doesn't have a great narrative. I think two of the things that Overwatch does that sort of put it in line with what we've talked about so far is it gave a lot of emphasis to characters with all the previews and short films and things, and really emphasized, like, have a main, be someone, collect things and identify with the character and such. There's a lot of room for player expression in that game, even though my diva is your diva, my Mei is your Mei, but I have this cool trench coat or whatever her costume might be.
Overwatch is interesting. There isn't a single player or any story component within the game. But I think that it's wrong to say it doesn't have a narrative component. And I think Blizzard's massive marketing campaign behind it matters. It obviously matters. It has to matter, because it was a way for you to talk about this game with even people who've never played it. That's almost Mario levels of zeitgeist penetration. You know what I mean?
Overwatch really transcended,
yeah,
the game itself. Like, there's so much fan art that people who really love, like, fan art, or like, they really love whichever character they like, have never played it and will never play it. Even me, like, I've played the game for all of a few hours, and I definitely have, like, favorite characters that I identify with, and if I see cool fan art of them, I'm happy to see it, comics and things.
So, if anything, I would say Overwatch is an amazing marketing campaign that managed to get itself into a space where we wanted to share stories about it. Not necessarily by only what's in the box, but all the material around it. And there was so much around it. Aside from the shorts, Blizzard had so many people with access to it, so many beta sessions even before the game launched. I remember, because only the last beta was truly an open beta, and when I got my hands on that one, it felt like I had 10 hours of experience in the game just from watching people play on YouTube. That does happen with certain games, but that doesn't happen often.
Yeah.
I can watch fighting games and I can understand, okay, this is roughly what I want to do, this is the situations I'm looking for, and then when I get my hands on the game, I'm not starting from minute zero. But with Overwatch, it felt like a lot of people started from hour 2 or hour 3 or hour 10, even before they even bought the game. And that's special. For lack of a better way of expressing it, that's very special. And it makes a lot of sense that it's here on this list, but not necessarily in an easily quantifiable reason.
Easy to talk about and consume in lots, yeah, of different avenues.
And I think that's the commonality that Doom and Overwatch has with everything else. It's easy to talk about.
And I guess in our last game is also a lot about the player conversations that happen, which is IO Interactive's Hitman, which is very small scale levels that have a lot of room for player expression and alternate solutions, and the games really aggressively encourage you to try all sorts of different things with the game. And one of the interesting things that I think Hitman did to make it very conversational was its episodic structure meant that players spent a lot of time just in the same level. So if you remember, the game was released in 5 episodes over the course of most of a year, I think. And there was a few months people would like do a level and they'd do lots of different things. Whereas if it had all come out at once, maybe a lot of people wouldn't have bothered experiencing the broader sandbox that was there.
Oftentimes with old Hitman games, there are many levels where you kill the target and then leave and never come back. But when that's the only level you have that's new, if not the only level you have, then you're more inclined to go back in and explore what other ways you could do things, right?
And it definitely leveraged like the games as service angle in order to like push players to try all these different things, which I think is really interesting. It's a little bit on the nose because it does do a lot of like try poisoning this person. So it can try and dictate some of that creativity, maybe a bit much, but it still demonstrates this huge, huge possibility space that makes it very appealing to talk about.
Simple enough AI that is complex and is a hindrance, but allows you to get interesting interactions out of it. The world does feel alive enough that NPCs react, and so you get something to talk about.
And they react consistently. That's important for these sorts of things, because you can't really learn a game that has genuinely good AI. Because good AI, well, good AI in terms of human-like, I mean, because people like AI would notice things a lot more quickly. Gee, that chef's gotten weirdly buff in the last 3 minutes. How could that have happened? So I guess this sort of year's theme is like conversational. Yeah, like these are all games that you can talk
games
about.
Games that are worth talking about.
Okay then. Well, I think that's plenty for 2016. Let's move on to 2017. Was a pretty great year for games overall. We had the Switch come out, the Xbox One X launched, Western game outlets talked about Japanese games positively as if they'd been hiding away for years, even though they'd been going strong for a long time. This year, we had, much like our opening year, Polygon and IGN gave the same game the award. Breath of the Wild by Nintendo EAD was game of the year for them, and Giant Bomb gave the award to Player Unknown Battlegrounds by the PUBG Corporation, which it's interesting to note that this is not a year that PUBG was finished. It was a bit of a controversy in games journalism whether PUBG could win the award given that it was in early access at the time, which is an interesting session that we might get to later. So Breath of the Wild won 2 out of 3 of the awards we're looking at, and it was, much like these other things, a game of conversation. It was a game that everyone talked about. It was a big event game, thanks in part to the fact that it had been very longly awaited. People have been keeping an eye on it for the better part of like 5 or 6 years, really.
Yeah, yeah. People have been looking forward to it for an even longer time, ever since Skyward Sword came out, basically.
And especially because Skyward Sword was not well received.
Skyward Sword didn't scratch the itch that a lot of Zelda fans had. That's the polite way of putting it.
And to be fair, neither did Breath of the Wild.
No,
Breath of the Wild scratched an itch for a lot of people, but it was not the Zelda itch, because it is very un-Zelda-like. Because it has a very systemic world as opposed to a very lock-and-key world, which is how most of the previous Zelda games function. So there's, even today, you constantly see people discovering new ways to do weird and clever things in Breath of the Wild. It's got a really avid speedrunning community because of this as well. There are so many ways to approach so many different things.
If any of the listeners listening right now like Breath of the Wild but haven't seen some of the things that you can accomplish via speedrun tactics, so-called speedrun tactics, it's definitely worth checking out. There are plenty of YouTube videos that cover some of the like rudimentary stuff. It's absolutely mind-boggling. And I think that's part of what spoke to a lot of people and why Breath of the Wild is an easy consideration for Game of the Year of 2017. We spoke before about possibility space, and by God, you could do a lot in Breath of the Wild.
And Breath of the Wild's really explicit about one major aspect of its possibility space being you can finish it at any time.
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons why speedrunning functions the way it does in that game.
Sort of at any time. By the rules of the game, you do have to do the first 4 shrines.
Yeah, you have to do the Great Plateau. Once you've done the Great Plateau, then you could technically finish the game. You probably won't, but you could. And I think just communicating to players that the possibility space is broad enough that you can go do this, and then within a few days of launch, there were lots of videos of players doing it, just helps everyone be like, yeah, I can do anything. I can approach all these things in different ways. And everyone broke the game. It feels like nearly everyone broke the game.
In some way, yeah.
But they all broke them in their own ways. Like for me, I did it through cooking. I cooked so many delicious foods that just completely ruined any challenge after a certain point. But it was fun, like, coming to that and telling people, like, oh, if you find this, you can do that. It really reignited the way people talk about liking games in the early 90s.
Yep.
Where everyone's talking about it and sharing ideas and how to do different things. And that way, it's really emblematic of a lot of the things that we've talked about in previous titles. There's a lot of possibility space, a lot of things that players can do that are different to each other that encourage conversation.
By the way, there are speedruns out there of not completing the Great Plateau and even not getting the Sheikah Slate and still beating the game. So,
yeah, although those feel more like the sort of glitchy speedruns.
No, those are glitch speedruns. In fact, the one without the Sheikah Slate actually involves making another save file, I think. So, definitely glitchy.
That's really cool, though.
Yeah, it is. If you've ever been interested in speedruns for whatever reason, Breath of the Wild is an amazing one to see how far the game has kind of just been pushed and how ridiculous it is and how much you can accomplish because the system is really so open. And no surprise that it's on the list at all. But I guess, yeah, what does have some surprise that it's on the list is PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds.
I thought that when we originally saw it there, but having, like, looking at the rest of the list in context, I think that it is 100% there and makes sense.
Definitely, absolutely.
The fascinating thing about PUBG was the tales that people would tell, like, oh, we were sitting in this house and we were waiting. We thought we knew what was going on and suddenly we were sprung on from behind. It was a great narrative engine in the sense of players making stories and telling them to their friends.
I remember when it was first discovered that having a frying pan in your inventory, because it hangs off your inventory on your character model, that frying pan is active and deflects bullets.
Oh, that's where that's from.
So if you're running and you hear tick, tick, ping, they've hit you, but they haven't hit you. They've hit your frying pan.
Well, that explains a lot of content I've seen online in the wake of PUBG. Because there are a lot of bad PUBG mobile phone ripoffs soon afterwards. And a lot of them had a lot of frying pan bases of advertising. Frying pan-based videos.
No, yeah. Contrary to what you might have thought, it's not actually a reference to Brock and his drying pan joke.
No, I mean, I didn't think that. I just thought, I thought the frying pan was like a weapon you could pick up in the game. But hearing this story makes it more understandable. Anyway.
But yeah, it's very systemic, despite the fact that it's...
Yeah, it's very systemic. There's a level of consistency to it, so everyone's on the same map. There was only one map in this year. It took another year or two for the second map to be implemented, absolutely. I believe.
Yeah.
And that meant that there was a great sense of universality to the stories. Everyone knew the frame of references.
People were just quoting areas off the top of their head. Like, I can't, because I never played the game, so I don't know what any of the map areas are. But, you know, they would be...
But they were universal. Like, it was a universal language for a while.
We dropped in Lighthouse and then ran to City or, you know, things like that. And everyone understands what you mean. Obviously not me. Yeah.
Either of us.
Oh, yeah, we're so equipped to talk about this game.
But, I mean, that's one of the things that is, like, it's kind of relevant that we don't know these games personally to some extent. Because this is about identifying the tropes of Game of the Year, not necessarily saying, oh, this game's a great game because.
Yeah. So the last thing I want to say about it is PUBG... It was obviously so important and would have easily made the list in hindsight. And it's just great that it got recognition in the time when it deserved it, even if it was a bit contentious of whether or not it should have even been considered.
Because next year was when everything else started doing it. And I believe that's when Fortnite started picking up steam, really.
I believe Fortnite Battle Royale was released literally in December of 2017. So the speed wasn't there yet. But yeah, the next year is when everything kind of hit the fan. so to speak.
Which is when sort of Fortnite really overtook. But anyway, let's move on to 2018, shall we? ...2018 was very much a year of continuation with no new notable hardware or devices. But there was one very distinctive game that took a lot of awards in a lot of different spaces, being God of War by Santa Monica and Sony. That was given the award by IGN and Polygon again. Giant Bomb gave the award to Tetris Effect by Monstars and Resonar Studios. So these games sort of buck the trend in a lot of ways. God of War is linear, focused with a strong story element that is universal to most players. There's not a lot of room for self-player expression. There's a fairly basic RPG skill point upgrade system and such, but everyone's going to end up the same pretty quickly, which puts it in a very weird space compared to everything else, I think. And Tetris Effect as well, just it's Tetris with narrative and aesthetics. These together kind of ruin what we've established so far.
Sort of. God of War feels really good, and I know we haven't been talking that much about game feel, but a lot of the games that have been Game of the Years definitely have just really good game feel.
Yeah, that's very true.
And God of War feels very, very good.
God of War deserves Game of the Decade almost just by the effect when you return the axe to you.
Yeah.
Because that boomerang axe just feels so good to use, and that return is just so immaculately perfect.
I want to know how much time and effort went into the Leviathan axe, because I would not be surprised if it was almost none, or if it was 1,000 hours.
Those are the only two options.
Yeah, it's either it was perfect from the beginning, or they spent way too long getting it perfect and it was absolutely worth it.
It's just a masterpiece of a minor effect, just making every single action so satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
It's worth saying God of War is open world.
Sort of, yeah.
Technically.
I argue it more than you do, but yeah.
I would agree with you. Like, the game keeps its open world in the same way that Assassin's Creed is open world, which is you can technically just go story mission to story mission and not engage with the open world at all.
But it is there.
Assassin's Creed makes it more organic that you will run into the open world. God of War just keeps saying, hey, why don't you explore? Hey, why don't you explore? Have you considered exploring?
God of War on paper also just ticks a lot of boxes. Like, technically speaking, it does so much technical excellence in it.
Yeah, it's extremely pretty. It runs really smoothly. It feels good to play. It's got top-notch voice acting. It was cinematically kind of interesting in that it is all done with a continuous camera. There is no cut outside of using pause menus and things.
Or if you die.
Which, like, I'm not sure how much I think the continuous camera really matters, but it's an interesting challenge that they undertook and did well.
I don't think that makes the game any worse. It probably makes the game slightly better in this case, just because they did it so well. But what mattered is that the team issued themselves this challenge that if a player never pauses the game, never dies, the camera is a continuous no-cut camera. And look, there are cheats. There are a couple of moments in the entire thing where there's pitch blackness. But that's so impressive. And that's so worth talking about and putting it on paper. Just saying, it's a continuous camera. Like, that's amazing.
And those moments of pitch blackness, like, very organic pitch black moments.
Yes, yeah. It's you got eaten by the world snake kind of moments. Spoiler. Sorry.
I think that's a fine spoiler. I'm not too concerned by people learning that Kratos gets eaten by a deity of some kind. It'd be more a spoiler if he didn't.
Yeah, fair. Speaking of Kratos, honestly, another thing that God of War had going for it, as short of a time as it has been from 3 to this one, it's nostalgic now. It's been a while.
Yeah, God of War is nostalgic. It's him growing up. It's also, because in a year or two before this list starts, Last of Us would have been on this list. And in many ways, God of War feels like the Last of Us of this generation, because it is a fairly classic, like, road trip story of parent and child going on adventure, the child coming to understand who they are and show off their strength and things. and the parental figure learning to be more emotional. Like, for the PlayStation 4, this is The Last of Us, even though The Last of Us is also on PlayStation 4, but as a remaster, not as the original. But yeah, so I guess, like, the amount of conversation around this was really about that guided narrative, and I guess this is here in the same way that Doom is. It's just very well made, with a dose of nostalgia to keep it relevant to people, and just being really well made and focused is a way to be on these sorts of lists.
Now, Tetris Effect.
I unfortunately haven't had the chance to play this, despite being really keen for it. Just various things have kept me out of it.
I've just avoided it until I can get my hands on a copy and play it alone and in VR. I know that's silly, but I kind of want my first experience in Tetris Effect to be in a VR environment, since everyone says it's really good. Not that it's, like, game-changingly good, but that it's a better experience than not.
Well, I think that it is kind of game-changingly good. Like, this director is well known for making games that are about really immersing yourselves in. He did Rez, he did Child of Eden, which, when you play it with the Kinect, is a really amazing experience. Or the PlayStation Move, even. So these are games that focus a lot on integrating the music into the gameplay. And Tetris has this function where when you drop blocks in time with the beat, you get a bonus, basically. You go into a flow state. And with VR basically making it consume your entire field of view.
Well, not just your field of view, right? Like your soundscape.
Yes. There is no sense other than smell and touch that, like, aren't, and even touch.
Even touch, you're holding the controller. Yeah.
Yeah. The game is taking up all the senses it reasonably can. And I'm sure the director would have made a way to taste Tetris if he could have.
So yeah, I'm super keen to get an opportunity to sit down with it in that environment. But from everything I've heard, the fact that it even makes me want to do that means it has to be something special. And I guess I am a small amount of surprise that Tetris Effect is on someone's list like this. But
I mean, Giant Bomb, one of the reasons we chose Giant Bomb in this thing is that nearly every other list was basically IGN's list. Like, IGN's list is very much the normal list for all these years, which is fine and reasonable, but that was boring to talk about, because it would have been really boring if this year was just everyone liked God of War.
No, I think Tetris Effect, I'm super happy that it's there, but a bit surprised, and that's fine.
Yeah, and I think it's another demonstration, like, things being just really well made can be a way that things get here. You don't have to conform to these things, but that doesn't mean that there isn't a trend. The fact that there are games that don't follow a trend doesn't mean that trends don't exist.
Yeah, and it makes it more interesting. It means that nothing is predictable. Nothing is fully predictable.
There's a level of nostalgia play here too, because this is Tetris really pushed in a really different direction. I think that is very fascinating, because Tetris does get a lot of adaptations, but they tend to focus on trying to do something clever mechanically. Whether it's Puyo Puyo Tetris trying to bring Puyo Puyo into it, whether it's Tetris DS trying to have all these, like, wacky game modes that use basic Tetris mechanics to do different ideas or what have you.
Tetris 99.
Tetris 99 making a battle royale. That's so cool. And then there's this, which really just takes Tetris and uses it as, it uses Tetris as a universal phenomenon as well. Like, the whole point is that Tetris is a language that everyone understands, and using that as a framing.
We talked about Mario before, but Tetris. Yeah,
Tetris is a framing device for this, because there is a narrative to this game. It's not told directly, but through all the background images and stuff that plays through the journey mode, interesting way to tell a story using a universal language.
Interpretive art as a game.
Some people argue that, like, the reason why a lot of indie games, art games, use the 2D platformer as their mode of conveyance is because that mode is universal. Like, with Mario, when you pick up Braid, that is a universal thing, even though Braid takes it in different directions. I think Tetris is sort of the other placeholder for what could be a universal language in games, even though it's reliant on other knowledge.
And I think that brings us to 2019.
Yeah, that brings us to 2019 and our own predictions. And now we're in 2019. Usually we would have this section be the rundown of what we had learnt, but I think we all know what we've learned so far, because it's been pretty consistent. I want to talk about predictions. We had some audience participation this time. Chase Farrow thought that the likely winner, so the winner that publications would list, would be Death Stranding, but that what he would nominate as the best game of the year would be Blaster Master 02. And Zolbrod thought that the most likely game would be either Resident Evil 2 or Death Stranding, saying that he thinks Resident Evil is the better game, but thanks to recency bias, Death Stranding probably has a higher chance of winning it. But that if they were choosing a game to win themselves, they would probably pick Fire Emblem Three Houses. What do you think, based on what we've talked about so far?
Oh, gosh. It's hard. I don't know why I'm building this up as if we haven't discussed this prior, but it is a hard decision to make, right?
Well, there is the one point of, we discussed this prior, but before we had all this conversation, maybe what you wrote down is different to how you now feel.
That's true.
Is it true?
that is true. One thing that has changed, I kind of wrote off Resident Evil 2 a bit too quickly, probably. I think it has more chance than I gave it during our discussions prior to this. But I don't think my final predictions change. My most probable one, I will say Gears of War 5. Not necessarily because I really think it'll win, but I hope if it's Death Stranding that it... I hope it's not Death Stranding, basically. And so for that, I said Gears of War 5, because maybe there's power in our predictions.
And I said Death Stranding to negate the power that you're trying to implement. No, I said that because I think that's the likely one. Just the way that people talk about it, the fact it emphasizes possibility space, and the fact that people are talking about it and their experiences and how there is lots of different experiences to be had in the game puts it very much in line with other things. I'm not sure I think it's the best game of the year. In fact, actually, I am definitely sure it's not the best game of the year, although I'm sure it's very good when I actually
sit down and play it. I will be gobsmacked if it doesn't take a Game of the Year award from somewhere.
Yeah, I think that some of the more mainstream outlets will give it the award, actually. Like, I think it's one of the more likely ones, but hopeful awards. We both put the same thing down for what we would like to win awards, which is a game that neither of us have played, which might seem weird to be the hopeful game, but...
I want to also make a point of note. This isn't our favorite. This is our hopeful. This is our hopeful because we think this has an actual shot of winning, even if it's a pretty low one.
Yeah. So we both put down Disco Elysium, which is, I wish I remembered who made it. That would have been good to check and write. But Disco Elysium is a sort of AA Western RPG style game that is set in sort of a noir modernish setting that is very much about roleplay. You do actions, you have skill checks. It's more about like actual roleplay though. So there is combat, but combat plays out more or less like a conversation. It's still, you pick options, you roll dice, and you see what happens.
It's made by ZA/UM. I don't know how to pronounce that.
ZA/UM.
Studios, yeah.
I think we'll say it's the abbreviation because ZA/UM sounds not great.
Yeah, that's why I didn't say that. So I said ZA/UM. Yeah, that's
right. Anyway, so there's a great emphasis in actual roleplay. And also, there's a great emphasis in failure is still a form of success. As in, when you fail something, that doesn't mean that you just quit and reload. You fail something and a different possibility opens up, which is what great DMs will often allow players to do. Like, when you fail something, it's just a different outcome. It's not good or bad. It's just different. And I think that's really powerful. And the way people write about it gives a lot of suggestion that maybe it's this generation's Planescape Torment. Of course, as we talked about with Shadow of Mordor, we're really bad at predicting what is going to be influential and what is not going to be influential. A lot of people thought PUBG would be influential, and yeah, that was right. A lot of people thought Shadow of Mordor would be, and they were very wrong. So time will tell, but I think this is a game that if any of the three companies we talked about would give it the award, I think it would be Giant Bomb and possibly Polygon. I don't think this is an IGN pick based on what they have picked in the list so far.
To further date this recording, this is being done 2 days before the Game Awards.
Yeah, so this is being done on December 9th, which means that by the time it comes out and you listen to it, it will 100%, the awards will come out and you will know exactly how wrong we are, which I think is the optimal time to release this.
Yeah, and I bring this up because we've talked about Polygon, IGN, and Giant Bomb, but I also do believe that the Game Awards are becoming an important voice in terms of what people listen to and form opinions around what are and aren't good games. And that's not a good thing, obviously, but it is a way the world functions. So
They're becoming more and more like the actual Oscars of gaming, which is like every site has awards for Film of the Year, but there's one award that people put a lot of weight onto. And I think that's fine and reasonable. If we did this a few years later when the Game Awards had more consistently established themselves as more than just a marketing thing, I would have included them instead of one of these companies, maybe. But as of now, I think they've got the backlog of being reputable, but I look forward to that. There is a level of marketing focus, but the Oscars also and the Academy Awards also have that to some extent. There's just that specific Oscar bait film that doesn't match the market's desires that is sort of the big differentiator, I think.
Yeah, going forward, we might just call it TGA bait. With all this said and done, this has been a good year for games.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who say that it hasn't been, and in the big AAA space, maybe not the most ideal year, but in the AA space, or even the indie space, there has been so much extremely, extremely good stuff. Sort of ever since August, basically, there has been so much amazing stuff coming out.
There was that weekend that was just absurd.
It was like Untitled Goose Game, Astral Chain, some other big indie darling.
Apple's, not Play Store, what's it called?
Apple Arcade.
Apple Arcade.
Which meant that Sayonara Hearts also came out, and that was an incredible experience. We had
the sequel to Mini Metro was in that as well.
Yeah, two or three days ago before recording, we had Saga Scarlet Grace come out, which that is definitely on lists for possibly being one of the greatest RPGs of this decade as well, based on the Japanese response to that. Because it came out in Japanese several years ago.
There are so many games that we can't list everything that made some kind of wave or impact, and no matter how small.
Like Sekiro came out and Baba Is You came out. Like
Judge Eyes was this year.
Judge Eyes and Yakuza 6, right?
Yeah, I want to say that. Yeah. I cannot undersell enough how important Resident Evil 2 was, I think, because that kicked off the year in a really, really strong fashion, for me at least. It was this game that became something everyone talked about. So based on what we learned today, that was why I was umming and ahhing about my choice just now. Based on what we went through in our conversation, if it's about discussion points, Resident Evil 2 and Sekiro stand a much better chance than I thought.
I think Resident Evil stands a much better chance of Gears, which I haven't heard anyone talk about other than, oh, it was good.
And so in talking about all the games that have come out this year, we've also each picked a game that, you know, meant something to us personally as well, as not contenders necessarily for a Game of the Year award, but that were important and mattered to us. And my pick for that from this year was Devil May Cry 5 by Capcom.
And it was a really great entry in a series that I at least never understood before. Like, this was the game in Devil May Cry that made me understand why some people don't like Bayonetta as much as Devil May Cry. It strips a lot of things I dislike about the series and emphasizes what I've been missing about it. Why is it particularly special to you, though?
Nostalgia, which is one of the things, right, that has come up. But interestingly, I guess for my case, it's not nostalgia for the Devil May Cry series, because I was introduced to it at Devil May Cry 4, which so many people say is one of the worst entries in the mainline games. I've talked about it on the show before. I think there's a lot that is really good in Devil May Cry 4. I think Devil May Cry 5 is just very well designed by developers that I really, really respect now to tell not the greatest story, but to present this like amazing mechanical experience going between three very different types of action character and, you know, having good beats in the mechanical reveals and things like that. It's personal. But with that said, you also had a personal game of note.
Yeah, it was really hard to pick originally, because your pick was very quickly, it's clearly Devil May Cry.
It is.
For the longest time, I had a different game on my list, AI Somnium Files, a really lovely visual novel adventure game. But in the end, I picked a 2D fighting game called Fantasy Strike by Serling Games. I've been a big fan of Serling Games since they started doing board games a long time ago, but finally the developer has managed to get a video game out that is sort of, in essence, a simplified Street Fighter game that has a lot of the interesting dynamics of 2D fighting games without a lot of the hassle of learning intricate combos with annoying timing. It just gets right into the situations that make those games interesting immediately. Because it delves right into the things that make fighting games interesting, it does bring up a lot of difficulties really early on for players. But it's so fun to just teach people and watch them get to grips with it so quickly compared to other fighting games that it's just made getting people into fighting games such a joy. It wouldn't convert someone who just didn't want to play any fighting game, so it's not Smash in terms of approachability, but it definitely helps show people what I love about a genre, which I think is really cool and interesting.
In a prior episode, we talked about Promises Fulfilled. This isn't specifically related to the time frame, but this is a Promises Fulfilled game.
Yeah, so Lynn has been talking about this game for a very long time. Like, really, this game's initial conception was with Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo HD Remix for the Xbox 360 back in 2009 or so.
You mentioned that Sir Lin dabbles in board games. Most of his board games are based on this fighting game, which didn't exist when he designed those board games.
That's true. It was a big joke of the board games that they were the spin-offs of a fighting game that didn't exist.
Yeah.
Which is a fun joke. It makes explaining the metaphor to people really difficult because Puzzle Strike, a game you and I both love, it's a board game spinoff of the puzzle game spinoff of the fighting game that doesn't exist, which is a cool joke. It's nonsense to explain to someone who doesn't know about any of this. But they all use the same characters, and it's interesting finally seeing these characters that were supposed to be fighting game characters actually being fighting game characters.
Yeah, so I really enjoyed this game for what it is and when it came out as well. You know, there's a part of me that wishes it was more, that it did more to fulfill its goal of being an accessible fighting game, but can't have everything.
I wish that it was more approachable, even if it's very accessible to people. This would not convert anyone, but that's fine, I think.
It's still an amazing piece of game with really good netcode.
With really good netcode. We were able to play between Japan and Australia.
Tasmania.
And it wasn't perfect.
No.
But it was much better than even, like, Street Fighter 4 when you're in the same state.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a huge testament to how well it used the GGPO netcode. And with that, thank you all so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed Year 2 of Platforms and Pitfalls. We've really enjoyed the second year. We've done a lot of different things and experimented with a few different formats, sometimes well, sometimes not so well. And we really appreciate you being here and listening through it and offering your support.
I don't think we're quite perfect yet in what we want to do and say and how we want to approach this, but it's, you know, it's an ongoing learning experience, right?
Yeah, and definitely the things we tried this year that were a little different were big learning experiences that I think will help us be much better in the future. And yeah, we're looking forward to another year. We're going to change up our endings just a little bit. We want to invite a little bit of mystery. So we're going to give you some of the games we'll talk about with January's episode. And I want to see if you can figure out the remaining two games and possibly even the topic. So we're going to talk about Breath of the Wild, Scribblenauts, and Super Smash Bros. Brawl. Specifically, not the other Smash games. There are two more games. Can you guess our topic? And with that,
thank you for listening.